Welcome to episode 1 of the Tri-Unity series. I'm Randy Moggins from offplanetradio.com. This series marks the first time I've committed to doing material in a formatted, concept-driven show since my original Threshing Floor shows ended in 2011. I believe this material not only ties together the concepts that have driven Off Planet Radio, but have also formed the basis to move the discussion forward into the maturity of human understanding about who we are, what we know, and where we are going, both individually and as a race of beings. The series is based on the most recent work of our presenter, Dr. Shamil Asher, and his search for unifying diverse subjects such as spirituality, science, sociology, and etymology into a coherent body of concepts that goes beyond religion or philosophy. A work that drives the listeners and readers to inquire deeper into the nature of God, man, and our origins, and ultimately the outcomes of these lives that we seem to live inside of a matrix with its controlled narrative of war, subjugation, and fatalism. The best way to explain our thesis is the following quote from the book, Soul Revolution. We live in a momentarily separated and reformatted universe that we may have in the beginning consented to join in with, but have since had the institutional false narrative wool pulled over our collective eyes and have been made to forget. These shows are about the remembering, the now present moment when the collective of mankind is beginning to stir. When the consciousness of man once again asserts its divine mission to move outside all of the controlled narratives and to reclaim the higher mind into which we were originally created. A little bit about our host. Dr. Asher is a Hebrew scholar whose main area of study has been in ancient Middle Eastern comparative religion and Semitic languages, with an emphasis on the Hebrew, biblical, and later period Judaic cult sects influences and effect on Islam and Christianity. After breaking from the modern version of his original Karaite Hebrew roots, Dr. Asher hails from an uninterrupted family lineage of Karaite Torah scholars whose family ties originate in the Galilee area of northern Canaan. Dr. Asher's earlier teachings advance the original ancient Karaite tradition of uncompromising data extrapolation and dissemination, and specific to the original Hebrew culture, traditions, and language from a more spiritually based root. His ongoing teaching effort has been to free people from man-made religions by distilling more ancient truths via the eldest texts available and in lieu of the latter period corrected texts and cultural traditions. He spent most of his childhood in New York and New Jersey, continuing his learning in his early 20s in Israel, where he received citizenship. During his formative years, Dr. Asher was exposed to the Christian religion extensively by those around him. Learning the Torah from the age of 7, he quickly identified that most Judeo-Christians and Jews of other sects were deeply misinformed on all levels of ancient Hebrew history and in need of clarifications. Thus, he ignores no opportunity or circumstance to teach anyone who would listen. In doing so, Dr. Asher has dedicated himself to the teaching of the Eternal Creator's original spiritual laws and path among all who wish to know and be separated from their narrative-driven religious slavery. To this end, and before publishing any of his books, Dr. Asher formed the Ancient Hebrew Learning Center, which has been the focal point for his free online and personal instruction worldwide. Those who glean insight from Dr. Asher include people spanning all religious faiths, all of which are people searching beyond their fundamental religions for a more original truth that eludes them. His factual, hard-hitting teachings demand a paradigm shift. To most strident religionists, he's at best controversial and at times even hated. So it would seem his exercise in truth must be hitting some very raw nerves, and with his latest spiritual adventure, Soul Revolution, he does not disappoint. We welcome to the program Dr. Shamil Asher, who is going to give us a little bit more of his personal background and development.
Karaite scholars, taught by my grandfather and for the most part of my life, since I'm about 7 years old, and kind of took it from there. Just I was led on that path, and that's where I've been ever since. The science part of all this, that was just because if I kind of was allowed to go my own way, I probably would have went to MIT or something, been a physicist, you know. But I was directed in this path, and this is where I went. So the science that is like in this book is, you know, by no means I'm not an expert. I'm all self-taught with that, and also taught in school, but you know, for just some classes here and there. So it's not a whole lot to me. I'm a pretty simple person, trying to get people set on the right course. I think it's time for that. I think this particular time in history has come around again where an enlightenment is happening all over, and I think I was brought to this point to help with that, just one of the many. There's a lot of people doing it, a lot of people bringing that enlightenment in different ways, from different facets, different directions, and we all have a part in it, you know. Nobody's extra special, so to say. So I'll leave it at that.
Now, the work that we're discussing in this series, Soul Revolution, the Trinity of Humanity, is part of a larger work that you've been doing for a very long period of time. And a lot of it, obviously, is a work that you've built in some of the work going back. My specific reference point is The Land of Meat and Honey, which you produced several years ago. But this work appears to be a little bit more comprehensive in terms of what you folded into the mix, which includes things like science, quantum theory, some pretty advanced anthropology, as well as the background into the spiritual and religious side. What, in terms of your previous works, comes into play in terms of this book, and how much do we need to know about your previous work?
The most important work to me personally, and I think to everyone, is my first book, The Land of Meat and Honey, because as much as many people, you know, that's a hard one for most people, that one, that change, that lifestyle change, that paradigm shift that has to come about in that book, and that book is pretty special work. That, you know, from other people, with, I've been told many thousands of times now that it's either love or hate, you know, with that book. The work in that book is you're the creator either has, as I say, made your field ready for that seed, or it isn't ready. The people that grabbed that book, most of them, I have to say, it's been an overwhelming percentage of positivity that I did not expect it. I truly, actually, to tell you the God's honest truth, I didn't want to write that book. there were many, there's several understandings, ancient understandings that have been hidden, and that I was, I have other family also who are not from the Karaite, well, were from the Karaite background, but who had changed over to Judaism and to Orthodox Judaism. And were the first ones to tell you to hide that. Never tell anyone the actual name of the creator. Never tell anyone this, that, and the other thing. You know, these different things that I've hit on. And I'm not like that. I'm not one of those people that you can tell to hide the truth or lie about these things. So, but to tell you the truth, most people that I started teaching these things many years ago, here and there, other than the party line stuff, which everybody wanted, they didn't gravitate towards the true stuff. They heard it and were repelled by it for most of my life, actually, up until about 10 years ago. About 10 years ago, there was some kind of shift, and I saw it happening, and people started seeking me out for this other information, and I started letting it out little by little, and I was still hesitant because so many people are also resistant, and especially teachers. You know, anyone who's you can't reteach a teacher. I found that out. So you basically run into all these guys who want to debate you and everything like that, which was always a very bad idea to do with me because my background is so in depth. I've lived it since a child. So, and with the language and the culture and the details upon details upon details, that they can't win these arguments because they just don't have that background. And I got to a point where I had to stop debating people over these things because it didn't help them. It actually hurt them if I did it in public, which I did, and with my what used to be less than humble Brooklyn attitude.
Yeah.
You know.
No, I get that.
I kind of relished at driving them into the ground right in front of 500 people. And then, you know, I thought about it after a while. I said, you know, would my grandfather have done that? Did I ever see my grandfather do that? And I said, no. He didn't. He was so humble, he didn't. He would tell them what he was going to tell them, what they asked, and if they didn't want it, he walked away. It's nothing, you know, it's it.
What is the old saying, a man converted against his will?
Oh, the one I used in a book, that's from my friend. We looked high and low to where that came from. We could not.
I have never found an original source for that. Is still unpersuaded. A man converted against his will is still unpersuaded. I've never found the original source quote for that either. And I've used it myself a lot.
A man convinced against his will remains convinced still, or something like that.
But what we're talking about in terms of the land and meat and honey and the 2,000 pound elephant sitting in the middle of the room, so to speak, it goes back to carnism. The eating of flesh and the edicts of these war gods that play out in the biblical Old Testament. And you know, I told you this privately before. You actually, in those two books, the present work, which is The Soul Revolution and The Land of Meat and Honey, identified some things that I was swerving into as I was closing out my threshing floor shows, which was the pantheon of entities called gods in the Old Testament. Because most people tend to think that Christianity and Judaism is monotheistic, but when I began to examine the Old Testament a little bit more clearly, what I saw were numerous god types, whatever you want to call them. I ultimately, you know, we go to the place where we begin to see the archons come into view. But this was such an unsettling thing for me at a time when I had torn up the ground all around myself and was basically sitting there going, well, I'm just about ready to fall through the earth now. And along comes your work with some validation done through scholarship that I don't have access to. So we have these really disturbing concepts. And, you know, I'm in favor of getting disturbing concepts out in front and letting people's resistance do what it's going to do, because, again, we can't convince anybody of anything except the truths that we're trying to expand out and why it's important to hear the thing. So those two things, the eating of flesh and the multiplicity of the gods inside of the Old Testament.
Right. The LMH, the Land of Meat and Honey, that's the beginning, all right? And then what happened was, I didn't even realize it was going to happen. When I wrote that book, it was a huge success among the people, among about 10,000 people or so that I had been teaching worldwide up to that point, periodically here and there. And they read it, and they said, oh, my God, this is exactly what I knew it was, but I didn't have the ability to put it all together. And that seems to be what I've been given to do, is just put things together so that what the Creator is already put in everyone's soul gets reawakened to a point. See, so that's what happened with that. But then a strange thing happened I did not expect. They started coming back after a month or so, month or two. And they started saying, oh, my God, well, if I don't have this Jesus character in the way I've learned him, not to say that he didn't exist, not to say he wasn't a great prophet, or that he didn't do what he did. I'm just saying the way they've learned, this is the superstition that they've learned about, that soul fear, as I coined in the book, if you remember, that soul fear is coming up, and they're saying, well, what do I do now? I don't have that. You know, you're saying that if I do this and I do that, and I'm returning to the Creator. Okay, I'm returning to the Creator. You've pointed all this out through the prophets, through all this, that, and the other thing that I believe, that they believe. You pointed all this out. So I believe it. I see it. I understand it as being true. So now I have to turn around 180 degrees and walk back in the other direction. I get that. That's what they're saying to me. But what else is there? And what do I do now? I mean, where does Jesus fall into all this? And where does that whole salvation thing fall into all this? And what about when the poop hits the fan and the whole Revelation thing happens?
The Armageddon.
And they were looking at that, going, well, where does this leave me? And simply, I could say to them, well, now you're completely covered. You're literally covered. And in a far greater way, but that's not enough for them. So I woke up one morning and I just had a strong feeling that I should turn my original thesis on the greater Exodus into a book, because that is what they need. And I thought, I'm thinking to myself, well, that can't be. That makes no sense to me. And I was kind of going back and forth in my own mind, like, what's going on here? Why should I do this? And I sat down one day. I kind of blew it off for a few days, and I sat down one day. And within 30 days, the entire Greater Exodus book was written. And when I went back and reread it after I wrote it, that's only then when I saw why that needed to be, because they didn't know what to do after the first book. They had lost so much baggage. They have never been that light. They've never been that free. And they didn't know what to do, because humans love ritual. And they've been taught to love ritual. They've been indoctrinated to love ritual. So when you start losing that baggage, they don't know what to do, most of them. So the Greater Exodus, then, when I put that out, they all came back and said, oh, this, now I understand. Without this, I didn't know what to do, and what was going to happen in the future. Where did this leave us? And so that's how that happened. And then I thought I was pretty much done. I took care of everything in those two books. I took care of everything that I was taught was hidden, the very important points, and I thought I was done. And, but this last book, I think, like I think you said, and many others now, allows those people who have already come that far through the first two works to now have the nuts and bolts to understand why it all happened and how it all happened and how they got to the point. It actually, they don't need this book, those people who are already living that everlasting agreement, who already, made that turnaround, a 180-degree turn. But it does give them a lot more nuts and bolts. And I'm big on the nuts and bolts.
Well, and what I see in this book, and you say people don't need the book, and maybe we would agree that, you know, if we were close to source creator and we were able to lean into our understanding of things, that would be true. What I saw in this book was there are entry points for a vast number of people out there, especially people who have listened to my shows over the years, whether it was Threshing Floor or the Exotica Off Planet Radio show, because right. we're talking here about a whole series of entry points that go into consciousness, quantum physics. Most of the agendas in play right now, the New World Order, the transhumanist, transgender, AI, singularity things that are going on. I see the level of concern that people have about these subjects, and I also see how rootless most people are out there in searching. And rightfully so, they've rejected, especially the dominant three monotheistic religions, largely because they sort of smell something in the whole thing that doesn't feel right. So I would say that the book, if it's not essential, is darn close to it in terms of how people can begin to have an entry point in understanding some of the things that are as current as tomorrow morning's newspaper, frankly.
Yeah. I didn't mean not essential to everyone else. I meant not essential
right. To the people who made the transition.
Right, who have already learned from me. Those people they're finished. They're done. They don't need anything else. But having the nuts and bolts is kind of nice to read. So for them, it's another aha moment. For everyone else, it's like I've had Dr. Thurman, I've had who's a big time naturopathic doctor, and other ones who have my friend Dr. Wong and others who have read this and said the same thing you did, that this is literally groundbreaking and changing their whole paradigm in such a huge way that, and truthfully, again, this is another book I didn't really want to write because I thought it was going to scare the hell out of everybody. I thought it would push too many people over the edge, to tell you the truth. And I'm just not getting that. I was totally wrong about that. It's not doing that. It doesn't seem to be doing that. So, but it's good because you get the nuts and bolts. And one thing I really can't stand about pretty much every teacher, every guru, every person I've ever listened to, self-help, whoever it is, they fling a lot of information out there.
Yeah.
And a lot of hyperbole, but they don't, you know, when you're all done with them, you're still sitting there going, well, how do I apply it? How do I get from A to Aleph to Tav? How do I get A to Z? What am I doing here? I get that all this stuff exists. I get that I should be like this. I should be better like that. I should act like this and like that or whatever, but what's the nuts and bolts of it? And that's what I strive for. I'm not going to write something that I'm not going to have the oldest possible proof of understanding to show you how to get out. And generally how to get out, like I tell from my first student till today, I tell everybody, if it's hidden, if it's hard to understand, or you need a special priest to tell you how it is, or to implement it, it's a lie. It's just that simple. And if it's simple to understand and you can just get it, you just feel it as soon as you read it, then it's the truth. That people just can't deal with that. They can't, a lot of people that I dealt with through my life, they look at, they'll read the books, or whatever, and they say, hey, well, what holidays do I do? What do I light candles? Do I do this? Do I, you know, what time of day do I point to the east and, you know, wink my left eye and raise my right foot? And, you know, what do I do? You already did it.
And the thing about it is, as you pointed out earlier, as humans, we like ritual. We like something canonical. We like something carved in stone that we can follow because it's prescribed and it's easy. But my path has not been easy. Yours hasn't been easy. And most of the people, the most honest people that I interact with, they're dangling out there a lot of times. And again, I'll just come back and say, Soul Revolution provides a way to integrate a lot of things that people are grasping at right now that are threads. And that this is not like blowing smoke or PR babble. I'm serious. When I read the book, I went, oh my God, this pulls together a lot of things for me in terms of understanding why I think certain ways, where I've gone with my thinking, where maybe where my thinking has diverged off of the path too far and pulled it back in. But we like ritual, we like structure, and we also like to think that we have to work for our, quote, salvation. That's sort of the dogma of all these religions, is the idea that these slaver gods have basically put us in a position where we're groveling constantly to be worthy of some attainment.
Right, and people have to remember, and that's what this book's about, part of what this book's about, is, as you say, is the fact that you are in their system. You know, just remember that. You're in their system at the moment. They didn't create it, and like I show in the book, they reformatted it. That's why the science was needed, because I couldn't just tell people, well, these other entities, which I know you believe in, the devil, you know, Samyaza, whatever you want to call them, they came here, they saw, they conquered, you know, whatever, and they reformatted everything. They took the original creation and they shifted it a little bit through frequencies and through this and through that, through technology, and especially through the false narratives, which is the whole basis of what I base all the book on, the false narratives that we assimilate and then create for them. So I couldn't just tell people that. I had to show people that here's where they came from, here's who they really are. This is what really happened in the garden. This is what the Hebrew really says, which is derived from either even older documents. So when you look at it this way, then I had to go into the science and show them that, and that's why the science was needed. And I'm probably the only reason why I gravitated towards science in my whole life is I didn't realize it would probably be for this. I just gravitated towards the science because it really intrigued me. It really excites me, probably more than anything other than certain things about my particular path excites me. But after that, then quantum physics excites me on a very high level, more than anything. Like I said, I probably done that had I not already had my path chosen, but that's what that science was really needed for, was to give them those nuts and bolts, to show them, to show people that, look, you know, this isn't just my opinion. Science is proving this, this, and this. You know, New Agers would say, and really polluted the pond for quite a long time. Oh, you're a soul entity, which you are. You're everlasting. You live forever, which you do. But then they took a little further into the you are a creator, you are the God, and all that. Well, all of that was true, except for the narrative was shifted just a little bit so that it would become a lie. And most people do see a lie after a while. And that's why I think that whole New Age thing lost so much momentum, because a lot of people started backing off, going, ah, come on, this is BS, and, you know, well, you know, now you're telling me I'm God, and this and that. So they took the truth and shifted it just, you know, 10 degrees left, and then it became a lie, so that everybody stopped looking at that. And see, that was the main reason to take that narrative off course, is so you would stop looking at it. So, you know, I say good luck to them to stop the, you know, short of nuclear war, they're not going to be able to stop people from looking at it now.
Mm, yeah.
You know, from this book. So.
Yeah, exactly. But
that, you know, and that's the important thing, I think, that they understand that that's why the narratives, the understanding of the narratives that they exist, and I guess we'll get into that later, of what they are, and those are all the important points I build on, and that's why the science was needed to prove to people, so that they weren't just saying, ah, it's just a guy's opinion, he's just a new ager, he's just and this and that, and that's probably what saves the book from being that, you know, just sounding like opinion on a lot of stuff.
So to kind of move us into what we selected as the initial show's topic, which is responsibility, I want to draw back to what I read. The excerpt from the book that I read at the beginning comes from page 37, and I was talking about the separated, reformatted universe and the fact that we have at some point, in some way, consented to be in this whole spiritual psychodrama over the course of many lifetimes. Now, the first red flag on the field is, wait a minute. My religion, my church, my faith, my rabbi, my pastor says that there's no such thing as reincarnation, as it's so called. So we have that on the ground, and then the concept that we have consented and that, in fact, we've been looped through some sort of soul reclamation program and wiped continuously. So pick any of that and just launch on it, because all of it's relevant to what we want to talk about in terms of responsibility.
Well, I guess, right. It's all about the personal responsibility. I said that the biggest issue is we'll have to start not only with personal responsibility of who you are, what your part was, and having to take the take responsibility for that and make any initiative to do that 180 degree turn. But the first understanding, I guess, which I put in the beginning of the book, was which I coined the metaphysical missing link. Was the consciousness gap, the consciousness gap in people's identity, that they don't, you know, people, I've heard a million times, well, you know, the biggest lie that the devil entity was able to convince everyone of was that he didn't exist.
He didn't exist, yeah.
Well, that's not it. That's not true at all. Everybody on the planet believes that this guy exists at some point, at some way, just about. So that's not, obviously not true. What I think, my opinion is that these entities caused everyone to forget who they were and what they were and why they were here. And that, in other words, forgetting your identity. And on top of that, probably the second biggest lie is the thing that he did was to make everyone not even identify everything around them as false narratives that feed into your consciousness, your mind, what you know, therefore get played out through the intention of your soul, of your creative ability. And that's why it's so important, as we'll go through, people will see, that to understand, get back to the understanding of who you are. It's complete amnesia. And so that metaphysical missing link, first and foremost, is that everyone has to come back to understanding the power and of who they are. And I don't mean that in a God sense. I mean that in that, like most, like I say in the book, and most people believe, that you are tethered to the Creator in some way. You are, God is, all right, the biggest one I've ever heard in my life is that people constantly say, well, God is in us, God is in us. Okay, great. Or that, what does that mean? You know, they can't tell you what that means. It's, again, nuts and bolts. They can't tell you what they mean. It's just taglines. Okay, but what that means is, because I will tell you what that means, is that the Creator's macro soul, his macro consciousness, created all the living souls that exist everywhere. This is by far, not the only creation. I proved that through the Hebrew a long time ago, and I have that in one of my other books. That all creations and all the living souls, eternally living souls, are created from his macro consciousness. Therefore, our soul is the micro consciousness, the micro soul from his macro. Therefore, you are literally part of him. The problem is in the reformation here on this creation space is that their false narratives, one of them being to make you forget who you are, their false narratives have caused us to reflect their image and stop reflecting, or not even reflecting. We're reflecting their image because reflection is equal and opposite, right? But what we're supposed to be in our original state is shining out, in other words, emitting his image, the Creator's image, which is a very simple image. It's an image of a Creator. It's an image of that gives life, not takes life. It's a creative image, period, end of story. There's no more to it, and there's no less. It's a creator, not a destroyer. That's what I've taught people for many years when you look through, because everybody reverts to the Hebrew text, right? So, or the Bible. So they look at it, well, there's, you know, God told them to destroy this city, and that's it, right? But as I always teach you, ask which God.
Stop
taking for granted that just because it's written in a book means it's real, or means that it's speaking about the Creator. It's not. In fact, I'll tell you that most of the writing throughout everything people believe is the Bible, all right, is not speaking about the true eternal Creator. It's speaking about other demigods, other fallen ones, if you want to call them that, that have usurped the creation, reformatted it, made you forget who you are, and now you reflect their image. Because why? Let us make man in our image. That's where that's coming from. That's
right. The Elohim.
That's who that's speaking to. So that's why when I go through in this book, I divide and I show you how the first Genesis story, right? Genesis 1:1 to about 1:9, 1:10, somewhere in there, even up to 1:26, is the original, as we're going to get, Genesis story. And then Genesis 2 from 2:4 on is the reformation of the first. It's why there's two. And I get into the detail of why and how this happened and what most people believe it is versus based on a documentary hypothesis and different things. But I go into that and I show you and I split it up and you'll start seeing that's what happened. And so that reformation process is built on our consent. And basically, like I tell everybody from the beginning, whether you're talking about the split from Moses, a certain amount of them split from Moses in the middle of the desert that people aren't aware of, that the narrative was changed just enough and then put into Western languages and became more commentary than translation, they don't realize that a certain amount of them split up. And that's why you have two mountains. So you have a certain amount of people, right, that listen to another voice, went to another mountain, and received another law, a second voice, a second mountain, a second law. And that's why we have the second law through the Hebrew experience, later through the Jewish experience, not the Hebrew experience, because those two are two different.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep.
Right. So, you know, but when you start breaking this down for people and you say, look, ask which God, ask which mountain, right? Was it Horeb? Was it Sinai? What's going on here? You know, but nobody asked that. The best scholars in the world, nobody asked that. they look at these things, it must be the same one, blah, 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 blah. No, it's 200-something miles as a crow flies, two different mountains. It's not the same one. Okay, so we look at these things, we see that there's always a narrative that brings us off the path, but the main narrative, as you're bringing out, is personal responsibility, and that's what the book's about at the core, is to understand who you are, where you came from, what you're for, what you're made for, which is so much far greater than this, and how these physical bodies are literally entrapping, are literally a housing for the soul, which we were never meant to be in. See, that's all part and parcel of the lie, and how the texts were manipulated a bit, and less manipulated texts. The texts are highly manipulated, but what's really manipulated, as I've taught people for a long time, is how they're taught. Because when you have the priest class in charge of the only texts, and you can't see the texts for thousands of years, then you really don't know what's in them, right? And so then I can teach it. What I know is in the text versus what I teach to you is two different things. So I teach to you many different things. I say, well, you know, it says this and this and this, and that word means this because the Hebrew words, many of them have two, three meanings, depending on the context. So I can teach you that in this context, it actually means this, which changes the whole context. But you're not going to read it because you're not allowed in that room to see the book. See, so you have to take my word for it. And that's where we've been for thousands and thousands of years. So, and after that priest class was broken up, the latest priest class, which was Rite Judaism, was broken up and spread out throughout the world, then it was a more active effort to just kind of pull together in enclaves, wherever they are, and not to deal with outsiders in that way and not teach anybody anything in particular, not allow them to know many, many truths. You know, that's why I live in the middle of nowhere in the mountains where they can't get at me, because I'm constantly breaking that law. I mean, I've showed people, even you want to talk about personal responsibility, look what Yeshua did. They killed him for it. Most people think they killed him for, I don't know, various reasons that Christians believe. But when I read that stuff, I saw very clearly, even through the English text, which was very funny to me,
yep.
Because even the English text, there were certain words and phrases that I immediately understood from, you know, because my brain is translating into Hebrew as I'm reading some of it. And I said, no, that's definitely an unmanipulated text, what he's saying there, when he's saying I am, and it's in capital letters, and you're like, why is that in capital letters? That makes no sense.
No, and this was the stuff that I was looking at as well, that the particular line, before Abraham was, I am. I mean, he's echoing back to something there that's very strange, and nobody has an answer for why that's there.
Right, and when I looked at Yeshua, I looked at what he was doing, and I firmly believe, and I, in my Asher Codex book, I went into this in great detail, showing people how he was actually using the true name of the Creator that was given directly to, well, that was given to, well, Noah knew it. Abraham was taught in the house of Noah in Ur, and okay, so that's how Abraham. See, that's where that connections. I reconnect that. People don't understand. They don't know the history that Abraham lived at part-time in the house of Noah with his sons, in the house of Noah. That's where Abraham learned the everlasting agreement. That's why Abraham was moved out. And that's why Abraham was taught or shown or said to be, you know, the friend of the Creator, and the friend of the Malachim, the what you call the angelic souls. They're just souls. They're not special. That came to him. They dealt with him because he already knew. There's that disconnect there. People say, well, how is Abraham like? All right, so God tells him to leave Ur, and he's in the wherever. He's in the Negev, and he's walking around, and he's got a lot with him, and blah blah blah. Why is this guy? What's so special about this guy? There's no four story. There's nothing. There's not much there. You see, and there's a major break. There's a whole lot of information missing. But when you have that information, then you understand, oh, I see, that's the connection. Noah is the connection, because, see, my other information, my other books, like Lamb and Honey, will show you that Noah was given the everlasting agreement and Enoch had it, and it was passed down, and it keeps being reiterated. So when we get all the way down to Yeshua, all right, Yeshua is not only living that everlasting agreement, that's why I believe people are starting to see that he was possibly changed over, or he was aligned with the Essenes, Zadokites, whatever you want to call them, in Qumran, because he was vegetarian. And, you know, of course, everybody started showing, well, the fish and the loaves, and da, 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 da. And I say, well, the first thing he did was stop someone from fishing. His first act. People say, well, what about, you know, when so-and-so, Peter, or whatever, whoever it was, Paul, I don't even know their name, went back after he died, and he went back to fishing. Well, he was disobedient. He was no different than you. How is that hard to understand? The first act was to stop these guys from fishing. They didn't fish the whole time, as far as I can tell. And I can show you through Peter on the roof with that whole thing that he was a vegetarian since he was born. He says, none of these things have ever, unclean things have ever entered into my mouth. Why would I do it now? And everything, if you look at that that vision that I think it was Peter that had on the roof, I think, of mm-hmm, some house. Mm-hmm.
The unclean things, yes.
Yeah, but they were all all the animals. It wasn't unclean animals. It was clean and unclean by the rabbinical standards. If you look at the stuff that's on there, it's all clean and unclean. It's varied. See, so he didn't just say, well, I only eat this, and this, you know, Lord. I don't do that. He said, I don't do that. None of that has entered my mouth since I was born. But see, but if you're not understanding from a Hebrew mindset, if you're not understanding or even know, because your soul has been made to forget the everlasting agreement, it's been made to forget, and the Creator has his other souls come down from time to time and reiterate to Enoch, reiterate to Noah, reiterate to Abraham, gets it, and then it's reiterated to Moses on Horeb, and then Yeshua, I don't know how he got it, but he got it, Jesus, Yeshua, whatever you want to call him, he got it, and he lived it. I can tell he lived it, and when you look at the different things he was saying, I believe he was killed because he was using and teaching people to use the name that Moses was given on Horeb to use. And in Judaism, now the Pharisees, right, in that realm, as I point out and show in my extra codex on this subject, that at that time, and, you know, kind of even today, but at that time, because the laws were such in this social fabric was such that if you uttered that name in public, you could be killed for it. It was a death sentence. It was literally a death sentence. Today, if you do it, if you teach it openly, it's not helpful to you. Okay, so they're not allowed to just murder you now. But that could change in the future.
Look at the Noahide laws that are sitting out there,
right? Which are an offshoot of the original
the Sanhedrin,
laws,
yeah.
Which I show in the Asher Codex. So it's all wrapped together, but it's all based on, as you'll see in the Soul Revolution book, as you know, based on forgetfulness, based on something firewalling our souls. I'm going to call it genetic memory, but the soul's not genetic. But that eternal memory that's stored up in the soul from life after life after life after life for God knows how long. I'm literally for God knows how long. That it's stored up in there. We don't have access to it in these bodies. So it's not until we're out of these bodies that we have access to it. But they have the narratives here that even work after death. So that's a very important point in this book that I bring the reader through to give them that full understanding, to understand that the idea in the end, in the very end, which is a very simple thing to implement, is to make yourself the antithesis of what they expect. is to change yourself in life to a point that when you separate from this physicality again, you are now incompatible. You're literally incompatible, and then you return. There is no other information until something else, another scroll, falls out of the heavens. I can find no more information on Earth, and I've had access to even the places in Jerusalem that have stuff that isn't even out, but I had access to. But the Vatican, I'm sure, has tons of stuff as well. Is it going to change much? I think the reason why it's hidden is for the same reason why the Levitical priesthood and everyone after them, including the papacy, changed the words, changed the original information, you see, because the original information aligned with what I'm telling you, okay? It aligns with what Yeshua was telling you. It aligns with what Moshe was telling them and what Abraham was teaching his people. It aligns with all that, and if it aligns with that, then you're not going to get it. See, so that's where all this has been going. So, yes, personal responsibility is the key. I'm sorry, I got a little long-winded there, but it's definitely a major key to this whole thing, because it has to be that you have to understand that without the personal responsibility, or even believing that. You are responsible from the beginning, because, like you said, and I say through the book, consent. That is like the one word that is probably the biggest word of all, any word of all time, consent. And we consented, like I said. People want to take it to the Garden of Eden, if that's what you want to call it. I go through that and I show you what that's all about. I show you the truth of what the words say. I show you exactly what happened there. Not what they told you would happen there. I show you exactly what happened there. All right? So if you want to believe in the words of that book, then you have to believe in the words of the oldest versions of that book in Hebrew. And so I'm going to show you in this book, I show you the words. I show you what the words mean. And it's very, very specific. And it's very enlightening. So it shows you that we consented, just like they did in the desert. They were contending with Moshe. Contending with the 70 elders, they were contending with them. They were vying for a position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Him, right? Who made you God? You know, and who made you king? And so they were vying for a position. And you know what? You're only going to do that for so long before the Creator says, "Okay, well, we're just going to pull away from you, and we're going to give the other guy a try." See, that opens you up. And then the other guy, the other voice. So, yeah, they followed a second voice to a second mountain and got a second set of laws. And even today, people don't believe me, even today, Judaism tells you, the rabbis will tell you, if they're honest, they'll tell you that Moshe got one set of laws, but we got another set. That's what they tell you. We got another set of laws. They call that the Oral Torah. Another set of laws. See, what they leave out is that they got another set of laws from another god on another mountain. See, that's the part they leave out. So they leave just enough out so it commingles. And people think, oh, well, it must have happened on Horeb. It must have been like, okay, Moses got one set of laws on Horeb and then left. And then they all came back. And then the 70 elders got another set. Yeah, because they were so damn righteous. So this is where it's going. But like I say, in the book, that before you can become truth, you have to embrace a terrible thought that you have always been the responsible party. At some point, we consented, probably through naivete. You know, we were naive, and you know that whole garden scene. You know, it isn't what you know. Wasn't an apple.
No, it wasn't an apple, and it wasn't a snake either.
No, it wasn't an apple. Well, you know, that's a funny thing. Seraphim in the Hebrew is what it says. It means a reptilian.
Yes, it means reptilian, but not snake in that.
Of a type of entity.
Yes, okay. Yeah,
so, reptilians. Yeah, it, it is connecting to an entity of some sort that obviously doesn't look very good these days after he got disconnected from the Creator during Enoch's time, which I also go into in the book and show you how that disconnection happened to them and why they've usurped this creation to continue living, because they can't live. They don't have that eternal tether anymore. And that's a big thing I get into the book, as you know, that all souls here and everywhere have an eternal tether, I call it, a tether back to the Creator. I often wonder if this is what people that when they die and come back, a lot of them have, and I know you've heard of this, that they say they see a silver cord.
Yeah.
This is that tether. It has to be.
Yeah.
So it has to be connected between the body that they're in at the moment, because they're correlated. Because once we're in these bodies, the soul energy correlates with the cells of the body, and that correlation is a strong attraction. So there's probably, unless you're completely dead, that silver cord probably disconnected at some point, but it's always connected somehow to the eternal one. And that's but the fallen one, the ones they call the fallen, these other disobedient rebel souls, I call them, they got disconnected. They got literally disconnected, and I show that in the Enochian text, that what the English kind of makes it sound like, you know, Christians say, well, you know, we've just been disconnected from the presence of God. Okay, now that they are correct in that for us, but not for them, not for those guys. Those guys were quite literally disconnected. And if you remember, I go into it and I show the description of how when Enoch came back and told them that they were disconnected, that something physical happened to them. That it says they fell to the ground, crying and screaming, writhing. Okay, that's kind of a little out of character for some great, you know, powerful angel, you know, soul. A bit out of character, I think. So you see that's a physical manifestation happening there. They were disconnected, and that's how I segue into later what everybody understands, or many people understand, as that, what do you call them, the energy vampires, I think a lot of people call them.
Yeah.
Right, so we get into that too, and that's how that all segues, and why it segues. A lot of people talk about, well, they're energy vampires, and you know, they suck the energy from our souls. Yeah, okay, why? Why? Why did they do that? How did they get there? How did this happen? It's important. The whys and wherefores are important, because it helps us to now come back to the realization of who we are, so that we can take that personal responsibility and say, oh, look what we did. I can't believe it. You know, what's funny is the Mormons. I have a Mormon friend, and he told me, one time, even before I told him about this, he started getting into, he's been trying to recruit me for years. He's a funny guy, but he gets into the whole thing where the Mormons evidently have some kind of belief that all the souls here are the one-third of fallen souls that came with this Satan character, that all the souls here evidently sided in the upper heavens with him when he did his first murder, like is spoken about in the New Testament, and then were put here or came here, something to that effect, and they actually believe that, and it's funny because they're somewhat correct.
Yeah, they are.
They're somewhat correct. They have the context a little out of form, but. No, we're not the ones that came from there, falling from there with them. We were here. We were already here. They came here. So there's many of them.
So they were invaders. Now, where is here and what is here? This will get, you know, we kind of go existential, but it's not really classic existentialism, because the big questions are who, what, where, when, and how. So where is here and who are we that these... If you go back to the Genesis mythology, and I've called it that, that's not an insult to Bible believers. I concluded a long time ago it was mythologically presented either to preserve it or to preserve the narrative that was represented there. But when you look at that, when you look at that narrative, it looks to me like, as I put in the series that I did back in 2011, somebody fell. There was a fall. There was something that happened, but it wasn't as obvious as what is presented in that narrative. So we have the creation of beings that we now call humans, but their estate, we'll use that term, was different. So what was it? How did we fall? And what conspired to create all of this?
Well, that's a big part of the book, as I think you know. But it's and you also have to realize it is a major point that people have to realize when they're reading these texts, that they're not always in order, and they're not linear as far as time goes. In other words, when you're reading a lot of these texts, you're reading it like, okay, this happened today, and all right, then Abraham walked over here, and it was, you know, the next day, and then he walked over here a couple days later, and then he went over here. Okay, so we're 2 weeks into this. No, not even close. And a lot of it has been taken out of order and put back in different order. It's been so messed with, you know, which I get into a lot in my first book, so I won't get into that here. But I just want to tell people that, you know, yes, it's a lot of it's out of order, and a lot of it's not linear as far as time goes. So, but what you're asking is, when the physicality of man came into play versus what our soul light bodies were before that?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so Genesis 3 kind of picks this up, and it says in the text, and I have nothing in front of me, I'm riffing through this from memory. I didn't memorize the Bible, so I probably will misstate something here, but it says, "Who has told you that you are naked?" Okay? Now, we're looking at literal language. We know those words have other meanings and that they're mistranslated, but just for the sake of the narrative. And it says that he covered them in the skins of beasts or animals. And you read that, you know, I mean, I was raised in an evangelical background. So I read this, saw it from the time that I was, 3 years old. And I'm thinking, also, it was like lions and tigers and bears, oh my, they covered them with animal skins. Right. But then you've got to go, at some point it breaks down and you go, wait a minute. Adam was supposed to be like taking care of the animals, so now they've slain the animals to give fur skins to human beings. And it all starts to break down if you go out logically enough to the place where I got to, where I went, wait a minute. What's really going on here is a descension into a lower energetic form. The skins of animals, the skins of beasts, that's our physical form that we have now. That's the human. Am I off on that?
Let us make man in our image.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Because the Hebrew, right, when we go into the Hebrew, it doesn't say that at all. It says, when you look at it, we were coaxed, those souls who were there at the time, those souls in their light bodies. They were plasma-based light bodies, which is what your soul is right now, which is why all the cells of your body, through science tells us, give off light. All the cells of your body actually emit light. How could that be? How could that possibly be without something else inside there causing them to create light? See, so here's the main point that we're talking about here. And this is the proof of the text. And this is all we have. Okay, so when you look at this, where it says they did something, whatever it was, I contend that they were coaxed into destroying something. That is the basis of Genesis 1 was the creation of free will. No light was created in Genesis 1. Okay, there's no light there. Light was created on the third day with the sun, right? So there's no light there. So you got to understand a lot of this is spread apart. Some things are interjected, whole sections of chapters. So we go to chapter one. You have, as I explained in the book, you have the light that's created is known as to be, even among scholars who won't tell you this, that is the system of the free will being created and implemented right there, because that's the first portion of creation, of any creation, because there's many creations. That's what the whole tree of life is. When you look at well, I won't get into that. But when you look into other things, the tree of life and and all these things, those can come back. They're part and parcel with this, what we're talking about. But when you look at the Eru, something was done there, and the only thing that could have been done to allow this to happen to us, because you have to remember, once you consent to following another voice, that's who you're now following. That's who now has jurisdiction over you, because you consented. Okay, in Genesis 1, free will is created, period. It's proven that it's the most important and most immutable law, because it's the first one created, even by our own standards today, but precedence, we call it. So that's the first law, free will. Okay, then I get into a lot of other things about how the souls, certain souls, like you were probably just speaking about, were bad, were disobedient, and there were other ones that were not disobedient. That's the Shamaim, the waters. Everybody talking about waters above, waters below. And that also doesn't mean that some of this doesn't have a secondary meaning like other people believe it means. Yes, it could have a physical secondary meaning of actual water. Okay, but that's not what's being spoken about there. It's speaking about souls, obedient souls and disobedient souls being separated, all right, being distinguished between. The Hebrew words are very specific, as you know, because you read it.
Yep.
All right, distinguished between and separated above and below. It just can't get any more black and white. So those souls, certain ones, were pushed away, down, under the higher heavens, which I also use other texts, as you know, in the books to prove, to show that, you know, first century Gnostics and people before them and after them all have writings about heavens above and heavens below and heavens in between, this thing. So, but the core answer to your question is that they did something in the garden that broke free will. You can't do that. The archons can't do that. All right, the devils, the fallen ones, whatever you want to call them, they can't do that. They skirt the edge. They're always right on the edge, you know, kind of like Bugs Bunny where he takes his toe and he draws a line, you know, on the sand. You know, a step over that line. That's how I see it. You know, so they're always inching towards that edge of completely usurping free will, and they will. I believe they will try at some point, but because of their hubris. That's what they had to do. They had to break free will. By breaking that immutable law of free will means that you destroyed or usurped another's free will. That's how it's done. Okay, it's the only way it can be done. So whatever happened in that garden, and I contend whoever it was, coaxed those souls, many souls, not two souls, into destroying something else, the animals, okay? Because the animals, if you go into Genesis 2, right, and everything, are created first. But I thought man was the apple of God's eye.
Mm-hmm.
Why wasn't he created first? That's interesting. See, so I get into that. I show why it shows the animals first, and why it also shows that the second creation in Genesis 2 was a reformation, and all this into Genesis 3. So you're starting to see a reformation. The animals were created first, because without the animals, which have the same souls, you know, or maybe at that time they had a slightly different soul. That's contended in Judaism. I contend that the Hebrew pretty much says that they have the same soul, the same soul portion as we do. All right, so somehow, evidently, those animals were destroyed. I don't know how. Nobody does. but it had to be by the soul, the hands of the hand of the souls that were there, in their light bodies, including the bad ones that were there. Okay, so they did that, and by doing that, as soon as we did that, we followed a second voice to a second mountain for a second law, to be under a second law. Okay, but we didn't read the fine print. We didn't know.
Now we're into lawyers.
And the funny part is, souls today do the same thing.
Yes.
They get mortgages on houses, and they never read the fine print.
Yeah.
You know, so nothing's changed under the sun. And so we didn't read the fine print. We didn't know what that meant. We destroyed something somehow, usurping its free will, and then disconnecting ourselves, not disconnecting, but distancing ourselves from the Creator because we chose. We chose wrongly. At that point, okay, then you see the other entity come back in, walking through the garden. You see the whole thing. Ah, where are you? Why? Who told you were naked? Naked, okay? See, who told you were naked? Who told you that you are now disconnected from the Creator? That's what naked means. They weren't physically naked because they were light bodies. They were plasma-based light bodies. That's what our soul is. So how could that be naked? It can't be naked. It needs no food. It needs no heat or cool. It doesn't need any of that. So obviously it's not naked. That's just, that's just allegorical. So who told you you were disconnected? Who told you that you were out of his presence? Well, I could feel it. I could feel something's changed. Must have been the answer. And then it says, like I show you in the, and as I show you certain Genesis texts there that are now translated mechanically, translated much more literally, that Jehovah, all right, that entity, took them and covered, well, in the English it sometimes says covered their skins, right? Or covered covered them with skins. Now, that's been taken all kinds of different ways. Okay, and admittedly, when you don't want to teach someone the depth of this, because you can't teach one little thing like I'm about to say and not teach the whole thing to anyone, right? Because as soon as you start teaching that one thing, it's, oh, what do you mean? How could that be? And, you know, and when they're too new into this stuff, as a teacher, you have somewhat of a responsibility to kind of just, you know, put the brakes on and show them, well, that just meant this, you know, just go with this for now. And then later, they can come back into it. So, but for this discussion, since we're talking to far more enlightened people, evidently, the Hebrew, all right, it says in the Hebrew that Jehovah, in the Hebrew word used or, in phonetic English, it might be O-R-E, or, means light. That most people will just say that means light. Okay, now it is sometimes in context used as light, but the literal meaning of that word is very specific. It doesn't just mean light. It is referring to an object, a mechanism, an entity that literally emits light, like the sun.
As a source rather than a reflection.
Yes, unlike the moon, which is a reflection, right? Like the sun or a star, emits light. So your soul body emits light, which is why your cells in your physical body emits light. So if you were out of this body, you would emit light, which is why I used the near-death experience of Michelle Abram in the book. Because when she died, and she went out where she went, and she was speaking to who she identified as a creator, she saw a very bright light. But unlike everyone else who stays in the system, in the Archon system, she didn't. She bypassed it. She went home. Just like all the other souls, like I show you in the near-death experience or whatever, past life regression therapy, many of them say, I want to go home, I want to go home, I want to go home. And the researchers are asking, well, what do you mean? You want to come back to Earth? And they said, no, I want to go home, I want to go home. Which they're saying that while they're in the heaven matrix, the false heaven matrix, that's because the soul knows when it's there, that's not the real place. That's why they're saying that. So Michelle went home, and she said she saw a light, but then she saw that the light was her, not the Creator. The Creator was the voice that was speaking to her. She didn't see anyone. It was the voice speaking to her, had what seemed to be a long conversation, and the light was being emitted from her because that was her soul in its original condition. Okay, back in its original condition. So in the Hebrew, going back to the Garden of Eden thing, event scenario, it says that this Yahweh character covered their light with skins, which translated means covered their light body soul with physicality.
Right.
With the physicality.
Yes.
That we're in right now. And that is part and parcel, you know, that stems from the choice, right? Everybody makes choices. And like I've taught from the beginning and everything I've written, there's only two choices. There's, you don't, everybody says, oh, there's only sins. There's a sin of this, sin of that. No, there isn't. No, there isn't. There, you can make two choices and that's it. Good in life or evil in death. That's the only two choices you get. And that's, you can put evil in, good in life, evil in death at the top of the page, and every single thing that your brain could come up with or anybody else's brain come up with underneath those two columns will revert right back to those two headings. That's all we have. We have nothing else. And the way our creation is created is morphed or formatted continually is based on the projection of energy, of information, of intention that our souls, that we have, that we learn. So what we learn, we project. So that's why I emphasize, well, the personal responsibility goes to that too, right? You should be responsible enough not to take anyone's word for it and dig and dig and dig and, you know, and make sure that this guy's right and what he's saying or that person was right. And so that you don't assimilate incorrect narratives, because that's the key. And that's what we're talking about in this book about personal responsibility, that until you understand that these false narratives, which are streamed, you know, live streamed through government, through religion, especially through all time, and with many other tributary streams, streams, pathways going out from there, making sure to grab everyone in different ways. These false narratives, which are usually negative, and if anybody really sits down and thinks about it, most of the narratives that we believe, we see, whether it's on TV, whether we hear about, whether we are, that are coming from these sources, are negative. They're negative. I mean, you know as well as anybody that everything in religion is fear-based. It's fear-based. If you don't believe this way, you're going to go to hell. You're going to go to this. You're going to be dead. You're not going to have life everlasting. You're not going to, and if you don't go to the Pope or the priest, you know, then you have to go through them. Because if you don't go through them, then you're definitely not getting in. And that leaves everybody else out. And you know, so this is why I always say if you have to go through a priest or a special entity or believe a special way, or if it's hard or difficult to understand, or you need a special person to go through to get to it, it's a lie. It's all a lie. So the control, and that's part of it. So not only misunderstanding or not understanding at all who we are, then we also have to realize that these narratives exist, and until we understand that they exist, and believe they exist, and be able to identify them, you know, and walk away from them, then you'll never get away from it. It'll be, you know, you're stuck with it.
But one of the things that you're talking about, the fear-based system, but everything's based on fear. If you look at everything around us, our media, our governments, Our government's here to protect us from the scourge of global terrorism, the Islamic enemy, whatever enemy du jour they wake up. The media, the advertising conspiracy, they're designed to fend off the fear that you might smell, that you might look bad, that you might be broke, that you might drive a horrible car, live in a terrible home. The entire system is fear-based. It's all based on a differentiation of two polar opposites that are all within the same continuum range of decisions that we make.
Right. And they're all narrative-based. They're all specific narratives. Like, you just rattled off a few of them, but there's many of them, and there's the big ones. And then, like I said, there's smaller tributaries that run from them and from them. But, the chosen narratives are provided by the earthly sycophants of these entities who are usurping this creation at the moment. And so by their handlers, which who you want to call them, but we don't, we think we know who many of them are, most of them in government and religion. And by their handlers, which are our captors, we extract those narrative frequencies, all right? We extract those narrative lines, those beliefs. They become beliefs. And when you believe something, it becomes an emotional tie, especially with religion. And when it becomes emotional, it becomes very powerful, as we know. But more powerful than most people know, because now it's become an emotional drive, and now your soul, which is a creative entity in this universe, in this creation, which I guess we'll get into much later, of what it is and the science of it, which we'll get into the book, which is very important to understand, because it makes you understand why your soul is able to work as a creative force in this creation. The science does have something to do with it. But what we're doing with their narratives, with all these false, what I call chosen narratives, almost all of them being negative, in some way, some more sublime than others, our souls assimilate them, we apply them, and then subsequently, we transform these narratives into physical reality, literal physical reality. Now, right now, you and I, or most people, can't do that and see the manifestation of it immediately. And I give those reasons for that in the book, go into scientific reasons for it. And it's good that we can't. Imagine if we could. That would be bad. We can't be trusted. Our souls, at this point, cannot be trusted to manifest any creational ability with any speed, not even minutes or hours. That would be devastating, okay, because most people can't be trusted because they're highly negative. They've been, even the most positive people who think they're positive all the time or believe they're enlightened, if we were allowed that ability, that speed of creation, all that person would have to do is get mad one time. And you know, so we have a long way to, I don't think we could ever get there in these physicalities. I really don't.
No, I've said for a long time that I believe the limitations imposed on us, one of which is time itself, or the time domain in which we exist, because time is many things, just from the standpoint of understanding computer science and understanding how time domains work. Somehow or another, time is what prevents us from this instantaneous manifestation that would probably allow us to blow up not just ourselves but entire universes, you know, as far as I can tell.
Oh, absolutely. I think if we were allowed, it's not only time, it has to do with speed as well. And I get into that in the book, why I personally believe that, why this particular creation has been slowed down dramatically to, 186,000 miles per second. And we can't create, manifest physicality any faster than that, which is very slow. So getting back to what I was saying there, just to sum it up, is that our souls assimilate these narratives, which are negative. They're specifically driven narratives, because I'm the Archon, say, I know how you work. I know how what your soul is able to do on a very small amount. So I need to get X amount of souls into this creation space, and I need to get them working for me. They won't do it if they know who I am. They won't do it if they know what I'm doing. They'll only consent to it tacitly now at this point. So basically, I just have to create narratives that you think are normal over time, sociologically normal. So these narratives, you know, so our souls assimilate them, right? Even unknowingly, even the smallest one. We apply them, we even assimilate them, and we have them in us emotionally on many levels, and then subsequently, we transform these narratives into physical reality. Now, not individually, but it has to be done collectively.
Mm, yeah, that's the next level to this, which I wanted to bring up. Go ahead.
Yeah, and in other words, collectively, we create. You know, we live in a world we unknowingly create. And collectively, we help to create it, but unknowingly now, because we've been made to forget. So it's with our consent that, you know, this can be accomplished through the usually negative control narratives. I call them control narratives in the book. And they supply the narratives in various forms. And by doing that, and I think that's, I go into the book and I postulate that's why you see, I think a lot of people, you might agree, that in the last 10 years, especially, the negative narratives, war, death, destruction, GMO, you name it, have really blown up. They've really sped up. They've really, they're just crunching them out there. Really especially so in the last 10 years, in the last 5 years even more so. And I go into that, why I think that is in the book. I think it's because they're trying to keep pace with a very great enlightenment that's happening in various forms, in various ways, but all coming. I mean, even if you look, and I don't want to harp on this, because I don't. But I think even as you look, just the amount of people, just in the United States, that are switching their dietary choices to both organic and especially organic vegetarian.
Right.
When you see people like that woman, I can't remember her name, standing up at the World Health Organization, giving a speech saying that we have to stop breeding cows, pigs, all the farm animals, have to stop breeding them, have to stop eating them, because they're causing this, they're causing that, human health problems. Now, of course, that's not the spiritual end of it. For, you know, some people are doing those things for health reasons, or, you know, but I think that's what they tell themselves. But I personally believe that their souls are being
directed, programmed, reprogrammed,
yeah,
pulled.
Yeah,
there is a consciousness wave that has come in that's pushed this. I've seen it. You've probably seen it too. Going back to when I was growing up in the 70s, this awareness of things like vegetarianism, veganism, organic farming. And it's been a very slow ramp up over about 40 years, but it has reached a critical threshold where now people who walk into their grocery stores are beginning to see options. And these options are based on marketing, obviously, but they're based on a perception that what we're doing is not healthy. I mean, we're eating foods that are packaged and foods that are preservatives, and they've been genetically modified, and they have all kinds of sugars and things in them that really aren't good for us. And then, you know, there is this trend, this movement, even within the core of our culture, which is largely centered around eating flesh, that we have to be more humane about how we're doing husbandry, farming, the abattoirs, the slaughterhouses, however you want to view that. There is this whole concept that's kind of rolled out. It is building momentum.
And the other side is also trying to keep pace with that, or trying to outpace it. And to the point where I've even read stories and even seen it. You saw what they did to Oprah. I mean, she's a billionaire. I mean, isn't she like the richest woman on the planet?
Yeah, she's certainly probably one of the richest people. Yeah.
And she went on this whole thing a few years ago. I don't know if you saw this. I was so intrigued with that. I couldn't believe it. Never watched a woman before. I can't stand that kind of stuff. But I just happened to be in the room, I think, when my wife had it on. And she was launching into this whole thing where, I guess because of her up and down weight problems, she was saying that she hired a vegan chef for the whole studio, and that all 70-something members of the studio were going vegan for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 30 days. And she wanted to see, you know, they did the health things, they did everybody's triglycerides and the blood tests, blah, 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 and, you know, beforehand, and the weight, and they went 30 days, and everybody was much healthier and lost a lot of weight, and then how many of them wanted to stay on it on their own was, I think, like 99% of them. Well, because she did that, I don't know if you remember this, but the meat industry guys just crushed her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they took her to court. They did a whole thing, and she's not the only one. There's even a guy here in Montana, a rancher, who came to this same realization. He was a cattle rancher, a big one, and I guess he started speaking out. I read this somewhere else a year or so after I heard about that Oprah thing. Actually, no, I heard it on Cowspiracy. I think it was a show somebody sent me to watch called Cowspiracy, I think it was, or maybe one of those. And the meat industry guys, you know, the head guy, they ruined that guy. They ruined him. They because he spoke out a little bit and said, you know, we shouldn't do this. We should. I can't even tell you what the guy said. He just spoke out negatively about the whole thing, eating meat and killing animals like this and treating them like this, and doing all this thing. That they crushed him. He lost everything. He lost his ranch. I think he lost everything. And the dairy industry is just as bad. So I look at that and I say, wow, that looks to me like desperation. When you start going after, you know, ranchers, and that guy's not the only one. So when you start doing that, I look at that as desperation. That they that dark side is, you know, swatting flies as fast as they can swing with both arms, and because this is happening, because they're losing profits, which they are. McDonald's is losing profits like crazy.
Yeah, they're closing stores, laying people off like crazy right now.
Yeah. So when you look, so there is this change happening. So, you know, and what the other side has been doing all this time, and what is trying to continue doing, is work through those control narratives, and just to put a, you know, parentheses around it, the control narratives are set out there and even changed and manipulated over time as needed to control the collective paradigm of all the souls. It's literally to control the collective paradigm, because once you are able to control a larger percentage to believe one way, on different levels, you can't get everybody believing on the same level, so that's why I say they have many different tributaries of the same thing that lead to the same destructive end. Then they're able to actually watch these things happen. I've said this actually unfold in life. Like you said, they use the media. I mean, the media has been their biggest tool ever. I don't think the Romans and nobody had anything like that. That powerful tool to just awash the consciousness of mankind in negativity or strains the way they want us to believe, to see and believe and to think about and to get worried about and to be fearful about.
We're bathing in it. The electronic medium, you know, going back to the creation of the radio, probably even the telegraph, but certainly forward with television, motion pictures, and now going into the digital revolution, has been the largest mind control operation in the history of histories, because it's enabled them to bombard us 24/7 using frequencies, by the way, that are laced as well with all different types of fear-based elements to them. So, I mean, this is monumental. We've never seen this before, as far as I know, in this creation. I mean, it makes the Tower of Babel look like a tinker toy structure.
Right, and when you look at it this way, that's why this information, which, believe me, I've been telling people these kind of things for years, and, a lot of them just kind of look at you sideways like what your dog does every now and then.
Yeah.
You know, and their eyes, after about 5 minutes, their eyes are glazing over. You can see them.
They start to drool.
Right,
they eventually go into like a delta state and drop off.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's an amazing thing, but that's that literally generational mind control, or not even mind control so much as soul control. And I go into that in the book on how they control the soul with this physical body. But that's the importance of this information now, I think, more widespread, because people have to understand how this is happening and connect all these dots. Even if I'm not right about, a certain percentage of it, it really shouldn't matter, because the core of it, of who's doing it, why they've done it, how they're doing it, and who you are in the process, and who you've always been, and that you've been made to forget, which is the worst thing.
Yes, yes.
It is the worst part of this. But again, and I know I get people calling me up and saying, Rabbi, why would God let this happen? Let us forget for so long. Well, now you know, right? So obviously, it's not forever. Now you know. But it's important in this lifetime, I think, especially because of the technology, to learn this stuff, believe it, and start changing, literally disconnecting from that hate, from that destruction, which is what the whole last chapter is about. That final chapter, I think, is the most important chapter in the book, because it brings everybody back to, if it was just that, if it was just everyone just stopped and said, I'm just not going to hate everybody anymore. I'm just not going to be mad about having to go to work at the moment. Yes, we're all slaves to that. There's no doubt that this world system is designed to cause that in you. But we have to choose to disconnect. And we have to choose to understand the very core basics, which are very simple, and how to make that 180-degree turn. And a lot of people have come to me and said, well, your first book, you're just talking about a diet. And it's like, no, man. If that's what you got out of that book, you need to go read it about 10 more times, because that is not what it's about. That is just the proof of your soul returning. That's all that is. It's something physical happens to people. Spiritually and physical, something happens to your soul. I have thousands of emails and phone calls of people, and they all sound the same. I swear, it all sounds like they all talk to each other. They all call or talk to me in one way or another and say, oh my God, I've been doing this for 6 months. I'm like a different person. It's the most incredible thing, even to me, to tell you that God's not true, because I didn't expect that with the first book. I expected serious ridicule with that book. I figured I was going to have to go deeper into the mountains, but it was...
into the caves. Yeah.
Yeah, it was the opposite, and they just came and said, and I got even people, I wasn't even sure, I thought, all these people are, most of these people are former Christians, and I know they're... They have a tendency of being turned on by the newest thing, and then it's gone 3 months later. They're not doing it anymore, so I'm just going to sit back. And, but most of them I've seen now years and not falling away from it. But I got to say, I think the most important change to me that I've seen was in the people who were in my family, who didn't embrace anything anymore, not really, because they felt they'd been lied to. They have nothing to do with religion. I don't care, this and that. And then when they read that book, because I sent it to them, I got calls back, and people that never wanted to talk about this stuff before had 1,000 questions and were saying, oh, my God, I never looked at it like this before. This is a big thing. And, I've decided to do this. And I'm sitting there looking at the phone like, oh, my God, this is like body snatchers. What the hell is going on? Because I can't believe this person called me, and they actually read the book more than once. Mm. And have actually made the change before they even called me. And these are very close family members that, because you're never really accepted even.
No. A prophet has no honor in his own house, so said.
Something like that. So I was really blown away by that. That's when I saw something was happening, something was going on, that this was important. And because I'm just not like that. I'm not that kind of person. I don't walk around thinking I'm some special important individual to mankind. It's just, this is what I've learned, this is what I know, and I have spent countless hours in it, literally, and have far more knowledge than most people get in several lifetimes. So and I can't tolerate when I see people lying about such basic stuff, that is so easily, now with the internet, forget about it, you can go on the internet, you can find out every little thing in detail what these preachers and pastors are talking about this. Now, you can go on and find other scholars who are far greater for far long periods of time. What people like you were talking about, reincarnation thing. Christians, they're the first one. One life to live, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, it's given to a man once to die and then comes the judgment. Well, that's one scripture.
But it's true. But it's true.
Yeah,
it's semantics. All right, when they say, "Oh, believe like this," in this narrative, and say these magic words, you'll live forever. Yes, you will, in this system, over and over and over and over again. They weren't lying. You will. See, it's semantics. That which God, which God. No one asks these simple questions because they're not listening, because their souls are firewalled. See? And the narratives are allowed right in. So they read that, and they see that, and their preacher tells them, oh, you'll live forever, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you will. He's not lying, because he doesn't know. But the guy who instituted the narrative so sublimely, he knows. He knows. He's got you. You're going to live forever. Yeah, well, he's not lying. Your soul is going to live forever. It's just going to live here.
Yeah. It's gonna loop through the matrix endless numbers of times.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forget to tell you that.
Yeah. And that actually is the horrible truth for a lot of people. That's like,
yes.
Oh, well, that's true. I remember reading Michael Newton's book, Journey of the Souls, about near-death experiences. This is like 6 years ago. And I had read about near-death experiences before. I don't doubt that all of that's true. But when I read this and I began to think about what are we looking at here, that we seem to be able to move out of our bodies and go into some zone somewhere where then there's this whole drama that plays out. I mean, the classic near-death experience, you wind up, you go to the light, you land in a place, you're met by people that you know, you have the warm and fuzzies. Supposedly, you go through this whole cycle of being, I don't know, some sort of council thing happens, and then...
Yeah, I go through all those separate things in a book,
And boom, you're back in again.
Right, but a lot of those people are told... See, I think... Here's my personal opinion on the near-death experiences, on most of them. Because in the book, if you remember, I kind of categorize, I make new categories. Type 1... Type 1A, type 1B, type 2, type 3. And because that's what I see when I've read the different either near-death experiences or the guys who are doing past life regression.
Yeah.
you know, guys like Richard Martini and Dr. Bruce Grayson.
Right.
You know, the Virginia Near Death Institute, I think it is. When you get into so many of them and start to either watching the videos and things, or reading the actual papers on what these people are saying to them, I mean, it's unbelievable how these people who are from different walks of life, completely different places, never met each other, are all, I'm going to say, channeling for the best, you know, but I don't think they're channeling. I think they're actually just recalling exactly where they were. And they're just saying what they said then. And so much of it is identical. I mean, damn near identical. That, you know, after a couple of thousand, few thousand, 5, 10,000 times, it's just mathematically impossible that this stuff is BS. So,
well, and you would think that with the cultural differences, language differences, just the differences in personalities, there would be remarkable divergence among these case studies. Yeah. And you're right.
Yes. You would think that's exactly what it'd be, but it's the absolute opposite. And I got to tell you, I never really delved into that stuff, you know, too much in my life. I believed in it, and I believe in it. So I didn't feel the need to research it, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago. But, you know, for this book and before this book, I had researched it quite a bit, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. The similarities are just nothing short of incredible. And so that's why I broke them down in a book. I broke down, you know, the what did I call it, the love tunnel of light that everybody sees and gets sucked into, and then they get the past life review, and then they get the soul classes that they talk about, which nobody knows what they learn. And ostensibly,
yeah, you took a class, which is then wiped at the end of it. It's like, wow.
Yeah, it's all, and I go through it, and I give my opinion about what this all is for. It's all directed, I'm telling you, just like I say in a book in a far more detail, that when you look at this, and from when that soul goes through that and goes through the whole process, it's very obvious standing outside the process now, being able to hear about what's going on, that the whole entire process is directed for one end result, and that's to spew you out the other side into another live birth, forgetting everything. Although that doesn't happen to everybody, there's many, many thousands, I think, a year, of people, mostly children under the age of about 12 or 13, that are remembering their past life. But they're only remembering, see, and I go into that in the book. I go into different cases of it. I go into other researchers, great scientists that are researching this, so doing excellent work and proving that not only are these souls coming back, but they're coming back to the same geographical areas all the time. I found very amazing.
Yeah.
Of how she goes into all that. That's an amazing. It's only one page. I put of her work in this book, but you got to. People have to read this. It's just amazing how socioeconomic, the whole thing. I mean, how this woman figured this out, and they. So it all seems to be just this rotational device that they tell you can stay there for as long as you want when you get there, and but then they're, you know, spitting you out the other side as quick as possible. It seems from what these past life regression people are telling the researchers that it's very passive aggressive up there. As far as how that goes. But then you have the other type of near-death experience, whatever you want to call it, like Michelle or Dr. Eben Alexander. That's a big one.
Yep. Yes.
You know, and he's got a great story, a lot like Michelle's, and they're divergent. They are not the same as the 98% that are getting revolved through the, what I call, from the Adam Eden matrix to the false heaven matrix. They're being revolved, you know, it's just this revolution back and forth, and some get past that, which is funny because that's what the Buddhists also talk about, that there's two lights, and not to go towards the one on the left, from what I was, so there, even in the Buddhist culture, they speak that there's two places you can go. So you want to, you know, do it their way and become enlightened so that when you separate from your body, you don't get tricked into going to the other one. And so, see, everybody seems to have parts and pieces of this, and that's because the narratives, like I say, get super spiritualized over time. The detritus gets built up, and you have little pebbles of them sitting on the top of the dirt, you know, and that's Buddhism grabs some of it, and, you know, Hindus and this one's and that one. Everybody grabs a little of it, and they think they got it, but until you start digging deep and get back to the core of that core truth of what it was, then it's very difficult. And that's very difficult to do. It takes a lot of time. And that's what I've tried to do with this book. But, yeah, it's an amazing thing with the revolution. And what I also, as you know, tried to do with, because I know a lot of Christians are going to read this. Well, maybe they might. But if they do, I do make sure in there that I give the history of the Christian church, the early Christian church, on how all the major fathers of the early Christian church coming out of the mm-hmm. Hebrew understanding.
Yes. Yes, this is huge.
Yeah, yeah. They all taught the same thing as the Hebrews taught, that we're being revolved. You know, the reincarnation exists. Origen being the most prolific writer of his time and the most well-known, that was one of his main teaching tenets of that, you know, until they doused him. So, I mean...
Yeah, for his trouble, yeah, he was burned, and he was... Well, burned again after that because they basically expunged his writings.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And why would you want to do that? Just like I postulate in the book, my opinion is, after you get rid of the man, you want to get rid of the writings because they wanted to teach their version, which makes that salvation that go only through them. Through their narrative, so once again they just got rid of those guys so they can continue to control the narrative, and that's what happened.
Yeah, don't forget too that they basically pillaged, looted, burned, raped, and destroyed the Cathars in southern France, the sect of Christianity that held to the doctrines of reincarnation and this whole hellish system that was. Actually being extrapolated, Rome had to stamp them out to install orthodoxy.
Right, exactly. So you see the same tendency of that evil, what I call the evil stream of consciousness, popping up whenever this gets big, whenever yep. wherever it starts flourishing. Yeah, it was of course a lot easier to do back then, right? Today, they made the mistake of allowing the internet. I find that amazing because...
this is quite amazing.
It is, because, of course, on one hand, I see them in a dark room smoking cigars saying, okay, we can use this internet thing and we can connect all the banks and we can take over this and take over that, blah, 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 blah. But I really don't think they had the foresight to see what we were going to do with it. So, you know, unlike... everyone back in the day, like you just pointed out, who were easy to encircle and stamp out, or one man like Origen and all the others that were before him, they were easy to stamp out. And who's gonna cry foul? Nobody, unless they want to be stamped out. But today it's a little harder because you know you have Amazon. You got books are out there, people are reading it, and you can't stamp out everybody. I mean, you can, but then what do you have left anyway? So. It is an amazing thing, though. But
well, I suspect that they are making moves. They would like to pull this in. On one level, a lot of this has already been let go, and I don't think you can pull it back in, and that's the optimistic side of it, is that, you know, for this period of time, we were given a technology that we could use to unleash the divergence. And on the other side of it, unfortunately, it's probably going to head towards singularity if it's not pulled back. So it's kind of a dual-edged sword.
Well, and that's why I say in this book, as kind of a warning, and I do point out the works and the quotes of Mr. Ray Kurzweil.
Yes.
and his ilk, who, like I say in the book, and he says that they are within 10 years of being able to pull the consciousness, the soul, out of a human and put it into what he calls a better body. And of course, you know, I ask, a better body for who? And I also know, with government stuff like that, or I believe I know, that when they're openly telling you that they're with, you know, they're going to have this or that soon, or they're within 10 years, that means they probably had it perfected 10 years ago. And so...
50 years ago, or where I can tell you from the amount of whistleblowers I've talked to, and even my own experience in the tech industry, seeing what was going on 30 years ago, that this has been a very long development cycle. Most of the externalized technology is simply cast off from an older system. And in fact, you have now a parallel Internet 3 that's running on top of our present system. So, I mean, Shmuel, they're going to do what they're going to do. Our goal is to basically push this thing as hard and as fast as we can go right now to get this out, because once it's out in the wild, it's pretty hard to put it back. And that's really the whole game of what you and I are doing. You're publishing books, I'm putting out shows, and we're just trying to get this information in the hands of people who can use it.
Right. And that's, like I say, I mention that in the book, because, you know, it could very well be that, and you see them at the top, this evil stream of consciousness pushing for, I think, world destruction. You know, everybody above ground, anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, as in the days of Noah.
Exactly, yep.
You know, only a few will be left, and, you know, we know who they're going to be, probably, or who they think they're going to be. And the problem is, and what I point out in the book, is that these archons, these, what we call the archons, or devils, or whoever you want to, whatever name you want to use, whatever they're in control of, this whole entire system, the technology that they're using, and make no mistake, they're making technology, and using technology, they can't create from the sound of their voice. They, you know, they can't create through frequency as the creator creates. They have to utilize creation that's already created in various ways to get what they want. So, no different than we do. You know, we cut down a tree to make a house. So, we didn't create the tree. So, we have to understand, and I point this out in the book, that it might be, in a, you know, at the risk of sounding narcissistic, okay, the information, and the way I'm putting it in this book, and I think probably the way others are probably putting it that I haven't read or know about, it very well could be the last chance to gain a widespread, if you want to call it, enlightenment.
Yeah.
To turn people around at 180 degrees, because that starts cutting off their power. See, we're disconnecting. We're throwing switches. Every single person, we're throwing a switch. Now, what I'm warning about in the book specifically at the end is, this might be the last time, because when you look at people like Ray Kurzweil and other stuff that you know they're doing, it's talking about being able to put your consciousness in a better body, what do you want to call it, a Cylon, like from Battlestar Galactica,
sure. Yeah.
Or something like that, some kind of other body. What that says to me is, we have the ability to take the energy of your consciousness, which I personally seriously doubt they actually can, but... You know, I have to leave room for the fact that I'm wrong, because the archons in charge could very easily give them technology that their little brains could never have even conjured, you know, on the best LSD trip possible. So I have to make room for the fact that they are receiving information, you know, directly, information and technology that they would never, ever, ever be able to get. So if that's the case, which it probably is, then if for the majority of people who don't have this knowledge, who don't come and assimilate this and understand it and believe it and just say, you know what, this is right, and I'm going to turn around and I'm just going to go the other way. And disconnect. And if they don't do that, then when they die and their soul goes back through the system that they control, then the next time you come down here, there might not be any more books. I'll be gone. Randy will be gone. A whole lot of other people that are telling you this stuff are going to be gone. Their books will be gone. And the better body that you're in is going to be highly controllable, much more so than this one. And it'll probably be that they just need the soul to animate that body, whatever it is, but not enough that anyone will ever be able to intuit even this stuff from, you know, the expanse above. So that's the risk, that one of these times they're going to create a situation, and I believe firmly that that's what they're moving towards, because everything, and that's another thing people have to get in their heads, that nothing exists except for control of the soul. Nothing. Nothing on this creation, in this creation, has anything to do with anything other than the ultimate control of all the souls here. That's it. Because if you control that many portions, and there might be 7 billion people on the planet soon, but that in no way means that is the total amount of souls that were ever here. It could be damn near innumerable.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Okay, of the soul energies, the soul bodies that are still somewhere else and, you know, captive, being cycled in, cycled out. So it could very well be that when they need more energy output, when they need to pirate more energy, they allow the civilization to grow and grow and grow. You know, go forth and multiply.
Mm, yeah.
Give us more energy. So they allow that, but then, you know what? Like I've shown in the book, as in the days of Noah, there is another story. There is another narrative about the days of Noah that's opposite. And it's ancient, and I find it interesting that it very well could have been the opposite. That certain people that were meant to survive, or a lot of them that did survive, not Noah but and his family, but others who he knows survived after the flood, it says it. It's very specific. It says it. It's all over Genesis. So we know that people survived after the flood, not just 8 people.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah.
All right, so whoever they were, they brought forward, they were probably the ones that brought that evil stream of consciousness forward and how it was rekindled. Or because if it was just as the Christians say, well, you know, it was only 8 people, and after blah, 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 they got out of the ark, and first thing they started doing, killing animals, right? So they get out of the ark, and that's it, there's 8 people. Well, okay, that's problematic. On so many levels, where do I start?
It's more problematic. That doesn't make sense. No, it's just,
no, and it's not. It's not even what the texts say.
No,
it's nothing. You know, it's not even.
No, that's
true
just
at
a
all.
Simplification designed for Bible school, Sunday school classes.
Yeah, it's just indoctrination. But it the long and short of it is that's what I put in a book. You know, at the end there to tell people, look, this might be more important than just dietary change and just a paradigm shift of your mind, just understanding the possibility of where these ancients came from, what they did, what they're doing. It's might be very important, because the next cycle, the next epoch, if they destroy this one, if they're able to destroy this one, okay, and maybe they're not able to destroy this one. Maybe that's where our prophets are telling the truth, are giving you decent information, that maybe they won't be able to, but it doesn't mean they're not going to try. In fact, I'm sure they're going to try. So I think that's what they've always done, is that they let the population get to a certain size, and what happens? After it's around for a certain amount of time, after so many cycles, the soul in this body starts bleeding through. It starts becoming more intuitive. It starts receiving information from nowhere that it didn't think it had before. So it starts telling other people, other souls. And that's how this spreads, see, as in the days of Noah. And then boom. See, everybody thinks that the Creator did that flood. He did not do that flood. The Destroyer did the flood.
Exactly. Yes.
So
all of that.
And yeah, you know what most people believe is one way is 180 degrees, because the lie is always 180 degrees, and you know, from the opposite direction. So it's I did mention that in there. You know that I think that's a very relevant warning. Excuse me. I think it's a relevant warning, because things are getting sporty out there, and I think they're going to get sportier soon. So it kind of behooves everyone to make a quick change, to understand how to change and move in the other direction. And you know what? It you just have to be seen moving in the other direction. And I think people make too much out of this.
Yeah.
You know, they think, oh, it's going to take years. I'm going to... You know, it's a whole other religion. No, I specifically say that in all the books. I'm never touting a new religion. I'm, in fact, against all organized religion. You know, I go back to the most original creator-instituted data that I could find. And I always know when it's true, because it's so ridiculously simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculously simple. And you know what? It just makes sense. You know, it just does. So, you know, people will a lot of times, hearkening back to the Land of Meat and Honey book, you know, which I refer to in this book a lot, because this book might be very helpful to a lot of people, and I think it will. But they're going to have to go back to that first book to get that information as well, and then couple it. And you know, and then, but I do get into that, and I get that from a lot of people saying, you know, well, you know, you're just, it's just a dietary thing to you and this and that. And it's absolutely not. It's a frequency shift, which I also get into this book quite a bit about frequency, the actual science of it and what science has found about the frequencies of this creation and what's all out there and what it creates and what it holds together. And a lot of this is important information, because you have to understand that even science proves that when you are ill, you are putting off, your body's literally putting off a much lower frequency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they know that, and they've proven that the optimal frequency for life in a human body is between 70 and 82 hertz. And animals are much lower, 20 to 25 hertz. And, you know, and I get into some things that surround that. But the understanding of the frequency, and understanding that when you are making that 180 degree turn and walking the other direction now, it could be for one day, you know, 2 days, one, you know, 2 weeks, whatever. Even the prophet Yeshua, Jesus, whoever it calls Jesus, in one of the, I guess, the Essene books, Gospels from the Dead Sea, area or where they live, is alleged from there. But even he is alleged to have said in the certain things which I put in my first book, that when you make this change, that you are physically and spiritually cleansed, whatever that means. Okay, I'm not even saying I know what that means. That you are cleansed from that in 7 days. For every 7 years, you are outside of it. Which I found thoroughly amazing. You know, when I read that for the first time, because somebody brought it to me and I thought, oh, this is kind of an apocryphal book, and I don't know how true it is. And I read it, and I read the different versions, different translations of it, which all tend to have a Catholic vibe because of the older translators who were, had that tendency with it. They were in that. But I did start to believe they were his words. And they were probably Essene teachings, because we know the Essenes were.
Yeah, that's largely where I'm at with that. I've done the connections as well, Shamil, and the connection between the Essenes, and then coming through Yeshua into the Gnostic writings, and the Gnostic writings have a lot of resonance. They connect a lot of the, even the Eastern cultures, the Eastern mindset. We've got to remember this was never a Western religion. It was never a religion, but it was actually a Middle Eastern to Eastern modality of thought. So it connects a lot of it together. Listen, we just packed a whole bunch of concepts into about 2 hours, and I want to give it some room to breathe. So as we go out of this talk today, Shamil, let people know about the books, where they can find them, and also your online activities, how they can find you and the work that you're doing on the web.
The books, well, they're on Amazon, but I also have a particular link, I think, that you're going to have on your website, right? So they can come to your website for that particular link, which is probably a better place to get them. And it's more direct to me. And I have my blog, which is the Ancient Hebrew Learning Center at Blogspot online. I don't update that very often because, you know, I'm just not one of those guys that are always just trying to tantalize everybody's minds. I just get in there when it's important and put stuff up there and for people to stuff that's outside the books sometimes, other science stuff or quasi-religious stuff that might be something to that I'm debunking on there a lot of times. So that's a place for that. But I don't particularly have my own website other than that blog spot. And so that's pretty much it. I've resorted everything right to the books, which are, I guess we can, like you say, we'll be on your site. And
yep. And we'll put all of that out with all of these shows, wherever you hear them, whenever you hear them, however you hear them. We'll put this information out. And Shamil, you'll be coming back for our next presentation. We're going to try and do these on a pretty regular basis, but I won't promise it's a week or 10 days. We'll do it as often as we both have time and will to do. So thanks for getting together today. This is the Triunity Series, and we'll be back again with Dr. Shamil Asher for another show very soon. I'm Randy Moggins. You can find me at offplanetradio.com. We'll be back soon.